At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There are something like 8,000 banks in this country, most of them in fine shape financially. It's the ones that aren't that we ought to worry about. But the FDIC said today it's got a plan to cover those losses. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by SunGard. 7 million K-12 students are enrolled in school districts that use software from SunGard Public Sector. More information at SunGard.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is a Tuesday today. This one is the 29th of September. So good to have you with us. We told you a week or so ago that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is in a bit of a squeeze. Its bank insurance fund was down to a mere $10 billion. Not as much as it might sound, given the pace of bank failures this year and to come, perhaps. Today, the FDIC said it expects banks gone bust to cost $100 billion over the next 4 years, and that its insurance fund could be out of cash by the end of the month. This month. Your money is safe. Don't mishear what I said. But Marketplace's Steve Henn tells us the FDIC is doing everything it can to avoid asking for a bailout.
The FDIC is basically bank insurance. It guarantees your deposits by charging banks a premium. But in the last 3 months, 50 banks have failed, and the agency's insurance fund will actually go into the red tomorrow. Still, Richard Beauvais, a banking analyst at Rockdale Securities, says don't panic. The FDIC's got your back.
It still has the ability to go to the Congress and ask for 150 or all the way up to $500 billion. It doesn't dare do so. In other words, the political backlash would be so enormous.
Instead, the agency asked banks for 3 years of premiums up front. This will bring in about $45 billion.
But it isn't going to be enough.
Richard Beauvais.
They're going to have to ask for more from the banks in the next few years, even though they're saying they won't.
That's because Beauvais expects at least 200 more banks to fail. And banking consultant Bert Ely says this is costing the FDIC more than it should, because banks are in such bad shape by the time the FDIC steps in and takes them over.
I find these high loss rates very, very troubling. Frankly, it's an indication of really significant regulatory failure that the losses have gotten as bad as they are.
Last Friday, the FDIC closed a bank in Georgia and immediately had to write off 45% of the bank's value. Losses that bad were almost unheard of in the S&L crisis. And until those loss rates come down, Ely says the FDIC will continue to burn through its cash. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn. For Marketplace.
Every day we rely on a mixture of statistics, indexes, and projections to tell us whether the economy is up or whether it's down, if things are getting better or maybe not. Today, in the maybe not category, we have a group known as the Conference Board. It reported consumer confidence dropped unexpectedly this month. As we like to do, though, we have been looking at a different indicator, and it says maybe things are looking up. Joel Rose explains.
At Neil's Motor Homes in Los Angeles, sales aren't what they were 2 years ago. But manager Jim Royal says some of his loyal customers are starting to come back.
This is their luxury. This is their luxurious toy. They maybe were taken back at first by the economy, but now they feel this is what we do. We're going to go ahead and enjoy our life.
An RV is no small investment in personal happiness. Recreational vehicles start at around $50,000. Mac Bryan is vice president of the Recreation Vehicle Industry Association. He says RVs are among the biggest discretionary purchases consumers can make, which is why they're often an early indicator of the economy's health.
When you look at traditional leading economic indicators such as housing starts, money supply, that's about where, you know, you find the recreation vehicle sales begin to turn. And that's both going into and out of recession.
Bryan says RV sales started to decline dramatically in May of 2008, long before the economy really began to flounder, and they started recovering months ago. Shipments to retailers were up 16% in August compared with July. Indiana economist Morton Marcus says that means RV dealers and buyers are finding it easier to get credit.
What it probably means is that the banks are finally lending money to RV dealers so that they can reestablish their inventories.
But Marcus thinks it's too early to make any big projections about fall sales. I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Iran's nuclear ambitions will be topic A later this week at an international conference in Geneva. Economic sanctions will surely be discussed, but the Obama administration is working up new ways to disrupt the Iranian economy. One would blacklist global insurance companies and freeze their U.S. assets if they cover cargo headed for Iran. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Despite existing sanctions, Iran has been able to ship goods through third parties using trading hubs in Dubai, Hong Kong, and elsewhere. Iranians can still buy smuggled Levi's, Apple laptops, and other American brands, and Iran has been able to maintain its critical gasoline imports. Researcher Cliff Kupchan watches the region for the Eurasia Group. He says a ban on shipping insurance is a sanction that's never been tried anywhere before.
It would actually be a very clever way at increasing the noose around Iran's economic activity with the world.
Smaller, independent shippers might be willing to take on the risk of shipping to Iran for the right price, but the insurance ban would block the most expensive cargo, so says Peter Van Tol, a New York lawyer who represents insurance firms.
If you're one of the major shipping companies or you're being asked to take over major amounts of shipments to Iran, it would be foolhardy for you to go forward without insurance because it's a risky part of the world and you could end up having a total loss.
The Eurasia Group's Cliff Kupchan says the move would hit what might be Iran's biggest Achilles heel.
One of the great ironies of the Islamic Republic is that while they're one of the world's largest producers and exporters of oil, they need to import 40% of their gasoline.
Still, he cautions Chinese or other so-called shadow insurers might step in to fill the void. And even without that, Kupchan doubts the move would get results.
They are dogged in their pursuit of a nuclear program. And it's my view that they would put the Iranian population through a tremendous amount of economic punishment before they would begin to change their nuclear policy.
Bills targeting insurers of Iranian shipments are already pending in Congress, but officials say the U.S. could also press for tighter global enforcement of existing U.N. resolutions. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
A moment now to note the passing of the public option. Passing as in demise, not passing as in approved by a vote. The Senate Finance Committee formally rejected two proposals for a government-paid insurance program this afternoon. Democrats on that committee said they will keep on trying. Traders on Wall Street tried today and failed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In the Senate tomorrow, climate change will at least try to steal some of the spotlight from health care. We'll get our first look at what the Senate plans to do to fight global warming. Their bill is expected to bear at least a passing resemblance to a plan the House passed earlier this year, in that it uses the free market to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Europe launched its market in what are called carbon credits 4 years ago. And we call them carbon credits because that's easier than explaining how they really work and whether they work. From London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
After all the turmoil of the recent past, this may not sound like the answer to our prayers.
Still heard the 65s last at 50k.
I'm seeing 65, 63 on screen right now.
A market in complicated financial products.
I was left with you
64 on 100.
But this market in carbon allowances could save the planet, says Mark Nichols of Environmental Finance magazine. It forces big burners of oil and coal in Europe to pay for some of their pollution.
Power stations, steelworks, cement plants, a whole range of facilities that emit carbon dioxide has to factor in the price of the pollution they're causing. the price of their contribution to climate change.
165, 164 was the tightest.
I'm just seeing it 65 bid on screen right now. I was wondering where you're.
This is the cap and trade system at work. Thousands of companies across Europe have had their emissions of heat-trapping gases capped. If they want to pollute more, they have to buy more allowances. If they've cut their pollution, they can sell their surplus permits. One allowance gives the owner the right to emit one ton of polluting carbon gas. Business is brisk, says Patrick Burley, who runs the European Climate Exchange.
We traded 95 million tons in 2005. This year, we will trade something in excess of 6 billion tons. So the market is growing at a phenomenal rate, and over time, will continue to grow at an even greater rate, I think.
A key to that growth can be found here in the Canary Wharf headquarters of Citibank. Some of the world's biggest banks have piled into carbon trading, Citi among them, buying allowances when they think the price will go up, selling them when they expect to fall. Garth Edwards is Citi's chief carbon trader.
I'm a trader, so the first requirement is to deliver some results. Those results are financial, first and foremost.
You can earn as much doing this, can you, as you would in currency or bond dealing?
The answer is basically yes. This is not some kind of charity operation.
Nevertheless, Garth and his team do seem to believe in what they're doing.
You will find among most people involved in emissions trading that they like that the ultimate objective of what they're doing is to deliver emission reductions and that that's a good thing.
I bet you don't drive an electric car, though, Garth.
I have a bicycle and that's it.
What about your colleagues? No Porsches or Ferraris? No.
Most of the trading floor out there have bicycles. That's probably more for fitness than for any ethical reason, though, but that's the way it is.
Some environmentalists feel there's nothing ethical at all about carbon trading.
Enter the climate casino. It's a massive free-for-all. The banks are already there and you can make your money too.
This group, dressed up as well-heeled gamblers, staged a protest outside a carbon trading exchange. They set up a roulette wheel on the sidewalk. Their message? Emissions trading is just another money-making game for the banks. Charlie Cronick of Greenpeace also takes a dim view of carbon trading.
What that has done probably better than anything else is generate a lot of profits for carbon traders and a lot of transaction costs. What it hasn't done is significantly reduced emissions from high carbon infrastructure.
The International Energy Agency says there has been a sharp fall in carbon pollution over the past year, but the bulk of that decline, 75%, was due to the recession. Supporters of carbon trading say it will, in the end, prove the best way of cutting the gases. But opponents say it's a con trick designed to convince us we can tackle climate change without any pain. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The price of crude oil fell today, down to almost $66 a barrel. For consumers who live in oil-importing countries, that will be welcome news. For citizens of countries that have a lot of oil, countries that don't make quite as much money when oil gets cheaper, falling prices might eventually be welcome news there as well. Peter Maas talks about oil and its disadvantages in his new book, Crude World. Peter, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
It occurred to me reading this book that oil is maybe the best example ever of too much of a good thing being a bad thing.
Some people refer to it as the resource curse. And what it means is that indeed, if you have so much oil and you depend on it for income, for exports, etc., that it can actually hurt your economy. You don't become richer from it, but you become poorer from it. And that actually, instead of becoming more peaceful and prosperous, you actually can become more violent.
There are countless examples in your book. The best one has to be, I think, Nigeria.
Nigeria is really the saddest story of all because it's earned about $400 billion from the oil that it's exported over the last several decades, most of which has gone to the United States. Unfortunately, there's about 80% of the population that still lives at or below the poverty level, and one out of five Nigerian children die before the age of five. And there's also kind of a low-level insurgency that's going on in the Niger Delta, which is where the oil comes from.
Describe it for me. Tell me what the Delta's like from your trips there.
I went into the Delta in a canoe, which is pretty much the only way you can do it. And it's almost kind of a scene from a panel of Bosch or something like that, where you're on this creek and you're smelling oil, and the land along the creek is virtually on fire because there are like flares coming out of the ground. there are army soldiers kind of that are ringed around these oil facilities, which are like kind of isolated fortresses. And on one side of a creek, you'll have this kind of beautiful oil facility with lawns, and it's got electricity and air conditioning and Wi-Fi connections. Other side of the creek, I stayed in this one little village, no running water, no school, no health care, no electricity. The only light that it had, in fact, was from the flare from the oil facility that kind of gave this Martian glow to the place at night.
There are outliers, of course, and I have to give a shout-out to my Norwegian heritage here. I mean, they've got North Sea oil, more than they know what to do with. They're a stable democracy with a great social safety net. How do you explain that?
Norway is a wonderful kind of outlier, which shows the lesson that it's best and, in fact, kind of almost imperative to discover democracy before you discover oil. Because Norway had, when it found this oil and natural gas in the North Sea, very solid civic institutions, so that when the oil was found, there was a national discussion that was resolved about how do we use this oil, who gets it, what do we do with the revenue. And once this kind of discussion was held and resolved, then the oil money was used in ways that were totally transparent. People could see where the money went and how it was used and that it wasn't wasted. And they also made the very smart decision to keep actually a lot of this oil money out of the economy, to put it into a reserve fund.
Is there a way that these countries who are troubled by their oil wealth can recover, can get out of this cycle, unless oil drops in value? And I'm not talking $5 a barrel here, but I'm talking drops in utility value, too. I mean, it's so widely used.
Well, I think certainly that, you know, if the price of oil drops, if oil becomes kind of less central to the world economy, then the economies that do depend on it, the political systems that do depend on it, that have been corrupted by it, will have to begin to reset themselves. But I also think there's some very progressive and interesting movements that are afoot. It's an organization called Publish What You Pay, which basically is what its name says, wants countries that have oil and other resources to declare publicly money flows, what the contracts are, how much money, what accounts it goes into, and have the ability for people to look at these accounts so they can know, okay, this is the amount of money we're getting, this is how it's being spent, and it's being spent well.
Peter Moss is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. His latest book is called Crude World. Peter, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new list of ingredients for low-income families.
Sugar levels, sodium levels, yeast levels, gluten levels.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped just under 0.5% today, 47 points, closed at 9,742. The NASDAQ fell 0.3%, 6 points, finished at 2,124. The S&P 500 lost 0.25%, 2 points, ended at 1,060. Companies in the oil business lost ground. Exxon lost 0.75%. Both Chevron and ConocoPhillips dribbled down 1%. Exelon slipped 0.25%. Housing news. Good housing news helped home builders today. Pulte Home stepped up nearly 1%. KB Home rose 1.5%. Lennar Corporation ticked up 0.8%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.3%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its final report on gross domestic product for the second quarter. The Senate Special Aging Committee examines how successful health systems keep costs low and quality high. And the House Armed Services Committee receives testimony on the status of U.S. operations in Iraq. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Downtown Beijing was buttoned up tight today. The government has closed shops and restaurants and hotels near the Forbidden City and Tiananmen Square to clear the way for huge parades this Thursday. October the 1st will mark 60 years since the founding of the People's Republic. The Chinese economy has come quite a ways since 1949. It's growing faster than the U.S. is, and it's a key player in the global recovery. The facts are right there in the data if you want to go look for them. Commentator Paul Kodrowski suggests China's numbers do bear a lot more scrutiny.
The Chinese economy is cheerfully mad. Consider some of these econo nuggets. New brokerage accounts are soaring, with more brokerage accounts in China than there are members of the Communist Party. Chinese car sales passed the U.S. in the first half of 2009. Beijing alone sees 1,200 new cars a day on the roads. Lending is also doing an up-and-to-the-right hockey stick. New lending by Chinese banks has tripled in the last year. And the country's GDP is forecast to rise a whopping 9% in the current year and 10% the year after. Under the surface, however, things are even stranger. For example, despite the tripling in Chinese bank loans, government data shows non-performing loans declining. While that's possible, I suppose, it would be highly unusual for more lending to be safer than less. Similarly, despite a big uptick in manufacturing, usage of gasoline has declined almost 8% in the last year. The two indicators had moved together until December of last year, but now they don't. How do you run an economy without gas? Cold fusion? And then there is how Chinese industrial activity has risen this year, but electrical usage in China has declined. How does that work? China's economic data and China's economy are weirdly out of sync, a little like the way Bernie Madoff's claimed trades never really matched up with the ticker. Now, I'm not saying the Chinese economic resurgence is a fraud. It isn't, even if it has more to do with government spending than people spending. So what is going on here? My guess is that it has to do with the awfulness of Chinese economic statistics in general. But that's just a guess. It could be that they're made-up numbers, or that massive state intervention has created the first economy in history where growth and energy usage periodically decouple. No one knows for sure, but China's is the most important economy in the world. So you would think more investors would care that its numbers don't add up.
Paul Kodrowski is an economist in San Diego, California. His blog is called Infectious Greed. You can check out our blogs. They're on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. And while you're there, tell us what you think about what you hear on the broadcast. Click on that link that says Contact. The federal government has been subsidizing food for low-income mothers and their children for more than 30 years. The choices in the WIC program, that stands for Women, Infants, and Children, have been pretty limited traditionally, mostly dairy products and baby formula. That is going to change on Thursday, though. Mothers will be able to use their vouchers for fresh produce and other healthier things like soy milk and brown rice, too. All told, WIC accounts for about $4.5 billion in retail food sales every year. And that has food makers hungry enough to make some big changes, as Rachel Dornhelm reports.
Fresh loaves of bread move down the line at Sara Lee's Bakery in Denver. The 20-ounce loaves disappear into a giant silver slicer. As they emerge, a blast of air blows off the crumbs before they're slipped into bags. All the usuals are here. White, whole grain, wheat, and something new, a 16-ounce loaf made especially for one customer.
We first heard about the new WIC guidelines about a year and a half ago. It was absolutely good news.
That's Heather Collins, a director of marketing at Sara Lee. The good news was the USDA was adding bread to the nutrition program. WIC's vouchers are issued for very specific foods in specific amounts. In the past, that was mostly milk, eggs, cheese, juice, and infant formula. Now, there's more variety, but with conditions. WIC-certified bread, for example, has to have over 51% whole grains, and it needs to come in a one-pound package.
So with that, we started working with R&D to formulate a product that would and could be utilized to meet the 51% requirement.
Turns out it's not like baking at home where you might just toss in some extra whole wheat. They have to consider
sugar levels, sodium levels, yeast levels, gluten levels.
And those weren't the only considerations.
We need to invest in 16-ounce pans because Normally, the marketplace is in a 20-ounce pan, so there was an investment on our part in order to, again, fulfill that requirement.
Collins says Sara Lee spent several $100,000 on the pans alone, but she says it's worth it. Tortillas have also been added to the new WIC menu. Jim Cabani is executive director of the Tortilla Industry Association. He estimates that if just 10% of WIC customers buy tortillas with their vouchers, that could mean $2 million a month in sales.
You know, you're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 800,000 consumers added to the pipeline of our producer members.
But again, it's not that simple. Tortillas are generally sold by count, 20 tortillas, 50 tortillas. Nutrition guidelines were scientifically determined by weight. Making packages conform could be hard for smaller tortilla makers, Cabani says.
They would have to, retool, resize the tortillas, which is a little bit, culturally not a good fit. Or make them thinner or make them thicker.
Same story for the soy foods industry. The nutritional makeup for WIC-approved soy milk didn't match existing offerings. So, again, new products had to be developed. At this point, you may be wondering why the WIC program didn't draw its specifications to meet products already on the market. Politics. To keep the food lobbies from trying to influence the product list, Lori True, executive director of the California WIC Association, says the nutrition guidelines were drawn up by the Institute of Medicine, or IOM.
The decision-making, which was very, very critical policy-making, was really commissioned by the USDA to keep it out of the lobbying and commodity pressure realm that's so prevalent in Congress.
Kevin Kincannon, Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services at the department, says the agency held hearings on the changes and worked with food manufacturers. He says some of them may have been particularly interested because of the recession.
In this economy in particular, I think manufacturers, processors, retailers, they don't want to readily concede a market or say we're not going there.
Kincannon says the downturn may make manufacturing and selling WIC products more attractive because demand is practically built in. And it's growing. About half the babies born each year in the U.S. are enrolled in a WIC program. I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, I know a lot of people, present company included, made much of the one-year anniversary of the demise of Lehman Brothers a couple of weeks ago. We said that's when the financial crisis got going, and that's true to a degree. But there is another school of thought out there that a year ago today is when things started getting really hairy. After Lehman Brothers went under, as you may remember, Ben Bernanke and then Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson went to Congress asking for $700 billion to bail out the banks. Their first proposal for the TARP ran just 2.5 sheets of paper. The 29th of September last year, the House said no chance and voted it down. The Dow promptly fell 777 points. The credit markets went haywire, and the financial crisis was really off and running. We are off and running this Tuesday afternoon. Just out of here, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 47 points, under 0.5%. The NASDAQ dropped 6 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 fell 2 points. That's about 0.25% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this program, a vicious drought in Kenya.
You just see them. Sometimes they just come asking for water, just for water to keep them going.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.